like to introduce tonight's main speaker, Hank H. from San Diego.
Good evening. My name's Hank. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 12, 1961. And every second of it is grace. Every second is a gift from a loving God. I could not keep myself sober for 49 days, let alone 49 years. And I am profoundly grateful to the God of Alcoholics Anonymous, whom we define on the wall as a loving God. This AA deal, this sobriety business, it ain't never, ever, 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 ever about you. If you think it's about you, you just might be in one rude awakening. And it sure as heck isn't about me. It is about you and I and God. It is about us. It is about we. It is about hope. It is about new beginnings. It's about love. More than anything in the world, it's about a loving God who looks down on our suffering children one at a time and says, "That's it, baby. Tomorrow you're going to a 12-step meeting." And when you go to that meeting, hopefully you will meet this wonderful person whom you will call friend, partner, and hopefully sponsor. And the two of you together will take an incredible journey called the 12 Steps of AA. At the end of that journey, you'll get to a place called having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. When you get to that place, you will have dismounted from the pony of despair, anger, loneliness, and sadness. You will have left the land of the living dead. You will be in a new place called a new freedom and a new happiness. And you will have one hand in the hand of a suffering alcoholic and the other in the hand of a perfect, loving God. And each and every day of your life thereafter, you will have two choices. Number one, you can remount the pony of despair and ride back into the darkness, back into the land of the living dead, ultimately to become a grim statistic. Or you can keep one hand in the hand of a loving God and the other in the hand of a suffering alcoholic. Just for today, I choose God. Every day when I wake up, I begin my day by saying, "Good morning, God. You remember me? My name's Hank. I talked to you yesterday. I'm an alcoholic. If I drink alcohol or abuse any other drug, including wacky tobacco and prescription drugs, today will be the beginning of becoming a grim statistic. And so please, dear God, please once again give me the gift of sobriety." And in the course of this day, because selfishness and self-centeredness is and will always be the root of all my problems, will you give me the incentive and the opportunity in some small way to touch the hand or the heart of another human being? And when I go to bed at night, I will take my little inventory and I'll ask myself, have I hurt anyone? Have I been selfish? Have I been dishonest? Have I been self-seeking? And if I've hurt somebody, it's not good enough to mumble an "I'm sorry." I made a career out of that. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I said it so much and so badly, I really got sorry." What I need to do is to walk up to that person and say, "You know, pal, I hurt you and this is how I did it. And I either did it out of malice or I did it out of ignorance, but nonetheless I hurt you. And I have a plan to make that right. I have a plan to make sure I don't do it again. And I want to tell you what the plan is and see if it's acceptable to you. And in the future, if you see me deviate from the plan, will you please bring it to my attention? Because I don't want to hurt you anymore. I don't want to hurt anybody anymore. This program is all about love. And I am what you are making out of me, one meeting at a time, one sponsor at a time, one sponsee at a time, one prayer at a time, one meditation at a time. So I'm going to warn you ahead of time, much of what I have to say is going to sound kind of mushy for a big guy like me. But I came here a mugger, and I came here full of anger. And I came here frightened. And I came here out to get you because I felt you were out to get me. When I was 12 years old, I had the lousiest year of my life. I adored my daddy and somebody killed him. And it broke my heart. And a little while later, I snuck out of the house and I went to sit on a swing at night so I could see the stars. And I felt a gun up against my head and I was dragged into the bushes. And afterwards, I was told, if you ever tell anybody, I know where you live and I will kill you. And so I started to barricade myself in the attic each and every night, memorizing encyclopedias, memorizing the Bible and the National Geographics. And I would sit there and I'd nod and I would have the light on and I would make sure that I didn't fall asleep. And then I'd go to school and I would fall asleep. And they would reprimand me and they would talk about me and eventually they called me the crazy one. And the law said that I couldn't quit, and my mother was the second law who said that I couldn't quit. And so they had a dilemma. And the way they resolved it was that he can sit in the last seat in the last row, and he can sleep all day long, and we'll pass him each year, because eventually we'll pass him enough times where we'll get rid of him. He won't be able to come back again. And once in a while they'd wake me up and send me out to get some stamps or to buy some chalk at the five and dime or whatever. And I had become so afraid of you. So afraid of you. And so what I did is in the daytime, not at night, but in the daytime, I would go and sit in the parks and I would bury my head in the good black soil and I would look at the grass and the birds. And I fell in love with God. I fell madly, madly, madly in love with Creator God, the God that made such marvelous things. I couldn't understand why he made people. I couldn't understand why he didn't just quit after he made me. That would have been good enough. But he didn't. He made billions of them. He still does. But now it's okay. Now it's okay. I love looking at a great big crowd like this. My brothers and my sisters, I love you so much. I'm glad you're all here to keep me sober tonight. I did that for a few years, and when I was age 16, I started to venture out at night a little bit again because I was about as big as I am now, and I passed a bunch of dudes in the alley, and I got curious, and I went in to see what they were doing, and they were drinking beer and wine that they had enticed the wino to get for him in return for a jug for him. And they offered me some, and I had never had alcohol before, and I drank it. And I had a couple hours when my whole world became wonderful. My sad, tortured little world for a few hours became wonderful. I fell in love with alcohol. God, what a glorious feeling that was. I don't want to tempt anybody, but as I felt it coming in and going down and tingling all my little nerves and making me forget all my anger and all my fears and all my resentments, I said to myself, oh my God, I found it, I found it. The next morning I was hanging out the bedroom window puking my guts out and I said, I will never ever drink this vile liquid again, never. That night I was roaming the streets looking for the wino to buy him and me a jug. And I didn't realize that I was in the late, late, late stages of alcoholism the next day. That's why I got to AA so early. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous when there were probably less than 100 of us under 22 years old in the world. I was 21. 1959, I couldn't take the pain anymore. I couldn't take the terror anymore. I couldn't take the beatings anymore. I couldn't take any of it anymore. We didn't have judges to send us to meetings. We didn't have DUIs. We had reckless driving tickets. We had a lot of things that were different. But I showed up at an AA meeting. I found out later on what happened. About 2 weeks after I went to that first ever AA meeting, I said to my mother, I said, you notice I haven't been in jail for the last few weeks? Do you notice I've been coming home at night? Do you know that I haven't been drinking? And she says, yes, what happened? And I said, I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says, thank God, he answered my prayer. It was the prayer of a mother that got me to my first meeting. I got to that meeting. I lived in Motown, and I went to the Hannon YMCA on East Jefferson Avenue, which is a gutted-out building today. I have a picture of it. And I had been to that building about 5 years earlier to play basketball, and I had walked down the hall, and there was an open door, and there were a couple people in one room and a book, and I could read the title. It said Alcoholics Anonymous. So I knew where I was going, and I knew how to get there. There was at the top of the stairs this eloquent, beautiful black lady. She looked like Mother God standing up there. And I said to myself, dude, don't make a fool out of yourself like you always do. Don't bump into that beautiful lady. And I had ring around the collar, and I had cuts on me from where people had been hitting me and where I had been attempting to shave with razor blades that were stinky. And I started up on the right-hand side, and she was on the left-hand side. And I got right to the top, and I said to myself, one quick right turn down the hall, and you didn't bump into the beautiful lady. I didn't make it. All of a sudden, Holly had her arms around my neck. She held me as close as she could. And she rocked my whole sorry little world in a half a second. I had the greatest introduction that anybody has ever had to Alcoholics Anonymous. She held me in her arms, her adorable arms, and she said, you're home, baby, we love you. If there's anybody that's new here tonight, I have a message for you from the heart of Holly. Pass my hands. You are home, baby. We love you. I went down to that room with Holly right next to me, and Billy was in there, and Billy was a Wynette who had lived most of her life on Skid Row. And then there was Bill, the white guy, the ex-politician from Washington, D.C. And there was Harold, a black businessman, and there was John, and John didn't say much. John made the coffee. He was a wino of many years. And I know they talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know they talked about the steps, and I know they talked about God. There are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Ever so slowly out of the sickness of my fog, ever so slowly, I began to learn a little bit of honesty. My alcoholism remained intact. And I sat there at those meetings, and I had a dual reality going on. Right from the get-go, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous more today than I did yesterday. I love it more this week than I did last week. I love it more this year than I did last year. I love this magnificent program. And I sat there loving AA with all my heart and all my soul and resolved that I would always, always go to AA meetings. And I have always, since Holly put her arms around my neck, gone to AA meetings. But I had a little problem. More than anything in the world besides AA, I needed a drink. And so 4, 5, or 6 times, I don't know how many, that's how sick I was. 4, 5, or 6 times in the next 2 years, I went back out again. And every time it got worse. And I realized that it didn't have a lot to do. It never has a lot to do with what's going on the outside. Because that kind of changes real quick if we're not drinking. I haven't been locked up in a jail since I quit drinking. I haven't been in a mental institution since I quit drinking. and a whole lot of things changed real fast. But where the problem was in my soul, in my essence, in my innermost being, or as AA says, my innermost self. I was alone, I was frightened, I was separated from God, I was angry, I was full of self-pity. It's called a bondage of self. And I couldn't know a new freedom and a new happiness. On August 12, 1961, they started to build a wall in Berlin. I was in Frankfurt, Germany, in the mental institution again. And I was looking at 20 years in the federal penitentiary for various and sundry crimes that I had committed while intoxicated. And what really, 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 really made the whole deal really, really, really sad, real sad, was that I didn't care. I just didn't care. And when I awoke in the morning, I don't know why, I do know why, but at the time I didn't. When I awoke in the morning, they had washed me down during the night, and I was naked, and I was laying in this bed with clean sheets, and the sun was shining, and it was warm. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was on the nightstand. And it was a little lady about 5'4", who weighed in at about 85 pounds, that went into the back of the nut house and put that book there. And the reason she was able to do it is she was the general's wife. And I guess the general didn't want to break his anonymity, so he sent Mama to bring the book in. And I slid off the bed, and I opened up the book, and I read the most beautiful, the most liberating, the most wonderful words that I'd ever heard in my life. After you're home, baby, we love you. I read that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, but God could and would if he were sought. And the love affair with God started to happen again. But it happened in an entirely different way, because now it included you and hope and possibilities and probabilities and new beginnings. I got to go real fast. The clock is biting me. I ended up back in Chicago. I couldn't go back to Motown. Too much history, too many memories. And I ended up at the L&L Group. And there was this old guy there, Doug was his name. Doug was a real alcoholic. He had one of those noses with the interstate highway system. If you wanted to go from L.A. to Boston, check out Doug's nose. You'll know exactly how to get here. And he had a Salvation Army suit on that I'm sure he paid about $4 for in 1940. And he ironed this thing because you could see your face in it. And he had this flowing white hair and this big white mustache with all yellow tobacco stains on it. And he had a bad case of dandruff. It looked like snowtime on the Rockies on his suit. And Doug come up to me after a meeting, and he says, "Hi, I'm Doug. I'm your new sponsor." I says, "You're what?" He said, "I'm your new sponsor." I said, "You're my new sponsor?" I said, "I don't remember asking you." He says, "I know, dummy. I've been watching you. You haven't asked Bill or Jim or Bob or Joe. You ain't asked nobody. And I don't care about your burning bush experience in the nut house." He says, "Burning bush experiences in the nut house don't count. There's a name for it. It's called hallucination." He took a piece of tissue paper out of his pocket. Had little green spots on it. He wrote something on it. He said,
be at that address tomorrow at 6. I kind of, you know, I was starting to, you know, clean up a little then. The next day at about 5:45, I'm eating popcorn. I'm watching Howdy Doody. That's what we did at the turn of the century. We bought $4 suits at the Sally, and we ate popcorn. We watched Howdy Doody. It was a simple life. It was what they called the good old days. And something was bugging me. And I kind of, yeah, you know, there's an address on it. And 15 minutes later, I'm outside this two-story cold water flat on the west side of Chi-Town. And I go up the stairs and I knock on the door, and old Doug opens up the door. He's got a sofa in there that he must have bought the same day when he bought the suit. And he probably paid $6 for the sofa. And then he had a potbelly stove with an orange crate next to it. And all this wood, pieces of wood. He said, guess what seat you get? I said, I know I'm not going to sit on the sofa. He said, that's right, dummy. Sit down on the orange crate. He said, and now that you're that close to the wood, he said, whenever it starts to get cold, put a little bit in there. That's your job. I said, why is it my job? His face got like purple. Imagine the white hair, snowtime on the Rockies, the nose, and a face that looked like a plum about to burst. He said, I'm the sponsor, you're the sponsor, that's your job. I said, okay. And I noticed some of the wood had paint on it. And I said, you know, you can get asphyxiated putting wood in the stove that has paint on it. He said, no, you can. You're the guy that's putting it in there. He said, and put the painted wood in first. Let's use it up. And I picked it up and I looked at it, and there was writing on this piece. It says, City of Chicago, Department of Parks and Recreation. I said, you're making me an accessory to a crime in the early days of my sobriety. I said, you broke the park bench up. He turned purple again. His nose was like boomeranging. He opens up the big book and he's shaking. He's all nervous. And he says, read this. And I read it. It said, a manner of living that demands rigorous honesty. He says, you know the difference between rigorous and rigid? He says, we grow along spiritual lines. Put the wood in there. I'm getting cold. Put the wood in there. I sat on that orange crate at least once a week for the next 11 years. If Doug hadn't died, I'd have still been sitting on it. I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be sitting on that orange crate and I'd be feeding that wood into that potbelly stove. And we talked about God and we talked about love. And I didn't work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not what it says in our book. It does not say how we worked it. It says how it works. It says if you want what we have, you're ready to take certain steps. We take them. And we prayed. We did all kinds of praying. And we took the steps. It didn't take 11 years. In fact, it happened real fast. And one day, middle of winter, 20 below zero, 20 inches of snow on the ground, 3 o'clock in the morning, I had to be to work at 6 and the phone rings. Yeah, it's me. The hell do you want at 3 o'clock in the morning? He said, we got a 12-step call. I want you to meet me at the corner of Mead and Grand in a half an hour. We got an alcoholic we need to see. So I went outside and I took, only folks that live back in the Midwest will know what I'm talking about now. And if you haven't, you don't need to. I took the dipstick heater out of the car. And I cranked it up. It was amazing. It actually started. And I drove over to the corner of Mead and Grand, and I
was sitting in the car, and it was freezing over, and the windows you couldn't see out of them. I knew the door was freezing. And so I said to myself, I better get out and stand on the corner and wait for Doug. And I waited and I waited, and Doug never showed up. But finally, I put a nickel in the phone, and I said to Doug when he answered it, I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm eating popcorn and reading the big book. I said, but Doug, you told me we had this 12-step call. And I'm standing here freezing my tail off. And he says, I know. He said, that was a practice shot. I wanted to see if you were ready. At that moment, I hated that man more than I ever hated anybody in my addiction. I made a plan. He was on the second floor. If I revved that car up at 80 miles an hour and I hit the side of the building, the whole building would cave in and he'd be under the rubble with a potbelly stove on his big nose and it'd be all over. But for some reason, I didn't. I went home. I had a couple hours to go, and I put the dipstick heater back in the car, knowing I had to go to work in a short time. And I got under the blankets, and I started to cry. Crying is the music of the soul. I started to cry. I realized for the first time ever that I had really unconditionally love somebody. I love somebody that didn't even exist. I was standing on the corner waiting for a Fig Newton of Doug's imagination. But I was ready. I was ready. This marvelous program was getting a hold of me big time. And I was ready. When I was right about 4 years of sobriety, God had given me this gorgeous little daughter about so big with blonde hair and blue eyes. Prettiest little thing you ever seen in your life. And I was just barely beginning to become her Holly. I was learning this thing called unconditional love. And like that, she was gone one night. She was gone. And I was comatose. And I sat in a chair. For 19 days, I got up to pee, and I got up, I think, to eat once in a while. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous were surrounding me day and night, and they were praying, and they were reading out of the big book, and they were holding my hand, and they were feeding me chicken soup. And the idea of taking a drink didn't happen. The idea of going back to the nut house was present, but that didn't happen either. We're running out of time. I'm going to go real fast. It's kind of hard to jam a half a century into 45 minutes, but I buried a second daughter a few years back. A year ago, last April, I met a lady who wasn't on the program, and she and I started eating hamburgers at McDonald's and getting to know each other a little better. We were getting to know each other real good. And she said to me one day, she said, I do drugs once in a while. And I said, okay. I said, here's the deal. Don't ever come around me while you're doing drugs, because I'll send you away real quick. And if you ever want help, I'll do everything I can to help you. And that was our deal, and we both kept our deal. I think in about a week and a half after the last time I seen her, I think she probably would have been ready to go to a meeting. But she was supposed to come over to my place. She had her place, I had my place, and she was supposed to come over one Saturday, and she didn't. And I made a few phone calls, and I called a mutual friend, and the mutual friend said that she had overdosed and died that day. I still love her, and I still miss her. And addiction still follows me around, even after almost a half a century of not using myself. It's cunning, it's baffling, and it's powerful. This is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you, please, if I can be so bold. Let me tell you the miracle. The miracle is not that I didn't drink when my two daughters died, when she died, when Doug died, when mother died, when brother and sister died. That's not the miracle, because each and every one of those days I asked a loving God to keep me sober. And that's a piece of cake for a loving God if we're sincere, if we come from the heart. The real, real miracle is I haven't wanted to. I have not wanted to mutilate my mind, my soul, or my body with a mood or a mind-altering drug since somewhere in 1961. And I used to think, as the old Drifter song would float by my memory, I would think, could this be magic? Because this thing still fascinates the hell out of me. And I keep thinking, could this be magic? And then one day, I realized that it couldn't be magic. Because magic is always an illusion. You find magic at the circus. And so if it isn't magic, what is it? If it isn't magic, it must be miracle. And if it's miracle, it must be God. And if it's God, it's okay. You told me find a concept of God. I found a concept of God. And I'll share it with you. And if it fits and it sounds good, take it as a gift. And if it doesn't, continue on your journey. And hold on to what you got. There are moments when I am so confused, so intellectually void, so unable to figure it out. And I'm scared to go to my head. And so I go to Papa God. I go to the old wise man. I go to Papa God. And I ask for guidance and direction. And then there are times when the kid dies or Anita dies. And my soul is wounded and I'm grieving. I go to Mother God. I go to Guadalupe. I go to Mother God and I let her hold me. I let her be my Holly, and I let her tell me, "You're home, baby. I love you, and it's going to be okay." And then there are times when I did like I did one time, stand on top of the Rocky Mountains in the middle of an electrical storm, marveling at Creator God, the way I used to as a little child, with my head buried in the black soil and the grass and the sunshine warming me. And I would revel and celebrate Creator God. All of this has to do with the dance of love, the dance of love with God. And then there are times when I want to run naked down the beach. And I want to eat too many hot dogs. Or I think I got a chance to make love to a beautiful lady. And then I hook up with baby God. And we have fun. And then there are times, see, I'm a bad boy. There are no spiritual giants in AA. Then there are times when I am aware of the lonely God. I'm aware of the wounded God. I'm aware of the God that cries. I don't quote the Bible in AA, but there is one story that I really, really like. I like the story. I love the story of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherd rolled in the 100 guys and the 100 sheep, and he counted all of them. He did his inventory, and he counted them, and he found out that one was missing. And some of the other ones said, "Forget him. It's his fault. He got lost. He's out in the dark in the land of the living dead. It's his fault." They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They get lost. And so the Good Shepherd goes out, and he cries in the darkness for my baby. Where's my baby? Before I wrap it up, I got about 5 minutes. I want to spend the last few minutes addressing the newer people. I'm the old dog and you the puppies. Listen up, because sometimes the old dog knows where the bones are. Okay? And I'm in the winter of this journey. I'm not going to have another 49 years. That's impossible. And when I got sober, I had to do the sorting out process like we all do, clearing away the debris of the past. And I have to ask myself, what do I hold on to and what do I give up? What am I going to need in sobriety that I brought with me to AA? And I looked at the word beggar. And I remembered that there were so many times when I would beg forgiveness again. I would beg for a dollar for a drink. I would beg you not to be mad at me. I would beg you to understand me, even though I knew it was impossible. And so I decided I would remain a beggar. I don't beg for dollars anymore. And I'm begging less and less for forgiveness. But everybody in this room, and especially everybody that's new, I wish to say this. The old dog talking to the puppies. You are, in fact, my brothers. You are, in fact, my sisters. And I've learned how to love in this program. Love and tolerance of others is our code. I am too old and too tired to be harboring silly, dumb resentments at people for petty little things when they accept me the way I am with all my pettiness. And so I wish you who are new, you who are relatively new, I wish you to hear this, please. If you're sitting here and you're saying, I've been in and out too many times, or I'm not smart enough, or I ain't got what it takes, or I can't make it. Those are the bones and the chains of addiction rattling around in your soul. Holler at them and tell them to get out of your sobriety house. Cling to God in prayer, meditation, inventory, restitution, service to others, a good sponsor, do service, go to a whole lot of meetings, and see where that guy goes. Because he will not be able to stand goodness and peace. And you are so fortunate, everybody in this room who is an honest-to-God alcoholic. I can't tell you what to do. I can only tell me what to do. I hope to God when I get home tonight, I will get down on my knees again as I did in that mental institution so many years ago. And thank God from the depths of my being for this magnificent gift. This has been the sterling event of my life. I am still the weakest creature that God ever made, and I am still full of faults and failings, and there's a real good chance I'm going to let you down tomorrow. But the difference is I know that, and I'm concerned about it, and I'm hoping it doesn't happen. And I got some tools when it does to make it right. And somebody might sit there and say, this guy's crazy. I am crazy. I've been to nut houses. I'm certified. You better believe I'm crazy. You're talking about making love to beautiful women. You guys are bad boy. You damn right I'm a bad boy. I went all this time and then I lost it. I told you I'm a bad boy. And God loves the bad boys and the bad girls. We're unpredictable. We're more exciting. We're more of a challenge. God loves challenges. If He made universes, God loves challenges like you and me. So let me close before I start really cussing. Let me close with an incredible prayer that we had in Alcoholics Anonymous when I first came around. Somehow we lost it. We replaced it with relapse is part of recovery. Tell that to my friend Anita. Tell her that relapse is part of recovery. We had this beautiful, beautiful prayer called the humility prayer. And please don't ask me after the meeting to spell it out for you. I'll give you my phone number. You call me up tomorrow when we got time and you got paper and pen. We don't have to look for it. Then we'll do it. Okay? Called the humility prayer. This is how it went. This is how it still goes. I say it every day. And I still, after all this time, music of the soul, teardrops, I still cry. I can't help it. I love it so much. God, I don't know what I am. Dear God, told you, I don't know what I want to be. Oh, dear God, I don't even know what I ought to be. Thank you, God. I ain't what I used to be. Thank you.